Anyway, my name is Ian Nicholson. I'm European Director is my title with it 24/7, but I'm just one of the guys on the 24/7. Just introducing, we've got, as well as Rich Dawson, who's on the programme, as being involved. So Rich works with us at 24/7. Was on the team we went on last year, and is also with his wife Callie taking the team next summer. And but in addition, we've got an added bonus because it was at the last minute. But we've got Deborah Paul, who they're based in London. You'll hear from these guys throughout it, but they very much the vision for the prayer room and so on. And Chris Yanastas, and if the eagle eye will see, it's the Yanastas house, so it's Chris's family home. But Chrissy now lives in the UK, and she'll be sharing a little bit of her story as well. So we'll keep it quite fast moving. I'm a little bit self-conscious coming before Christy, because in some ways we're talking about her homeland, if you like. But I thought it'd be good to start just with reflections. I've never been to Israel before, and I tried on several occasions, been close, but I'm so glad that my first experience was actually on this trip. And I just, before handing over to Christy, just some of my reflections, really, of we spent some time in Jerusalem and also some time in Bethlehem with Christy's family. Christy's family, as far as you know, are pretty well known in Bethlehem. Were you know pretty prosperous, large family. Every time I speak to Christy's mum, it's more family members that come through. And then suddenly this wall was built, and things were difficult before that, but it changed everything even further, really, in terms of opposite their home was Rachel's tomb. The house was built around a guest house, a tourist shop, and that was just blocked off. And it really struck me, you know, this, you think of this wall as straight. It's not straight. It's all sort of zigzaggy. And apparently the designer was given the brief to do it in such a way that as many Palestinians were on the Palestinian side as possible, and as many Jews on the Israeli side as possible, which is why it zigzags, which is why, as we'll see later, their home is surrounded on three sides by the wall. And I haven't quite realised the extent. I in my past, I used to work into Eastern Europe, and you could cross over, and probably the most memorable, if that's the word, crossing of the border was in Berlin, because you could be in West Berlin totally free, could do anything, and then you would get on an underground train through the Friedrichstrasse station, come up the other side of the wall, and you realize that everyone you were meeting had never been where you'd just come from 5 minutes before. And a wall was put up in Berlin which actually separated families. So if one family lived on one side of Berlin and one the other, that was it. And there were occasionally you could get to see them, but that was what happened. And so here we walk through a checkpoint 300, and I think what struck me is you come from a free side through this very grey, forbidding sort of all these different corridors and things. And what struck me, particularly, I've just been back again recently, was the Palestinian, mainly men who'd obviously been at work or whatever, but it's as if their shoulders were stooped and as if their heads were down. And it just felt like, almost like traumatized, or people who really felt downtrodden and subdued. And that's what hit me. Shoulders hunched and so on. And then finding in the Palestinian people incredibly hospitable. But again, to some extent, you got a feeling of trauma, which is probably quite easy to understand when you hear some of the story of what different individuals have gone in. And we went to, just around the corner from this house, is the Waldorf Hotel, which was opened by Banksy, the graffiti artist. And you go in there, and all his sort of stuff's around there. He's very pro-Palestinian. And there's a little museum there where it has the Palestinian story of the intifadas, the rebellions, and all that happened. And what struck me there was reading testimonies of Palestinian people who would say, you know, suddenly one day, the Israeli government or the Israeli forces arrived and said, you've got so long to get your stuff together. And then their houses were bulldozed and they had to then move. And you think, well, that's dreadful. And then the following day, we spent time in Jerusalem. And we went to the Yad Vashem Memorial Museum, which is the Holocaust Museum. And again, you're hit by the trauma that the Jews went through. And then you read the testimonies of Jewish people from the Second World War saying suddenly the SS would arrive and say, pack your suitcases, you've got 15 minutes to get your most precious belongings, and then you're coming with us. And you realize that almost like a traumatized people, and the traumatized people either side of the wall, in Bethlehem where Jesus was born, the Prince of Peace. And it just, for me, it just threw up all sorts of different emotions and feelings, that God loves the Jews, that God loves the Palestinians. Deborah's line when challenged, you know, by various people on whose side are you on? Are you on the Palestinian side or the Jewish side? And said, well, I'm on the Lord's side.
Yeah.
There are no sides. Yeah. And so we've got the opportunity to have a prayer room here. I will quickly add that what's, you know, the stats that I heard as well of just, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, there were 90% of Bethlehem's population was Christian. It's now about 6%. And so many have left, and the pressure that Christians have to leave, to give up their ancestral land, if you like, and just go. And pressure from both sides of the wall. And but then following that, we had an invitation just recently. Jill Weber and I went in September to go to the Garden Tomb, which is the tomb, it's a first century tomb right next to a hill that looks like a skull, that could well be the tomb where Jesus rose from the dead, but it's certainly, you know, it's a lot closer than probably what everyone else thinks is there. And the guys there, they get 450,000 visitors a year. Every visitor has the gospel preached to them. The staff is Jewish and Arab. We met a Palestinian Christian from Bethlehem who travels in each day to work there on the staff. It's a fantastic place. And they wanted us to go because they want to develop a prayer room as part of the Garden Tomb complex. And actually what we said to them when we got there is actually the garden is a prayer room. Obviously we can do a little bit of a prayer room to help give a bit of focus. But everyone, you know, all the people who work there say, so you walk in there and just everyone says, you just feel a sense of God here. And so within a year, we've had this journey of going to Bethlehem and developing a prayer room here, but also being asked to develop a prayer room in Israel in the Garden Tomb. And you think, suddenly you think, you know, there is a potential here to get prayer both sides of the wall, prayer for reconciliation, prayer for the wall to come down, prayer for people to find peace, not in politics or even in national identity, whether Palestinian or Jewish, but find peace in Jesus. Yeah. And maybe there's a chance here for a really fresh response of the Spirit to some, you know, it's a small thing, I mean, we're not the answer to the Israel-Palestinian problem, but a fresh response to what's going on there. So that's sort of an introduction from a 24/7 side, but I'd like us to, let's warmly welcome Christian, she'll tell us a bit of her story.
How many minutes do I have? Because
I said 10 minutes or so. But no. You're the most important bit. So if it goes for an extra five, that's fine.
That's fine. And someone needs to stop me when it's over 10 minutes, literally. So thank you all for coming. As Ian mentioned, my house is literally overlooking this wall. It's the only unique house that's surrounded by this wall from three sides, in the whole of the West Bank in Gaza. So. I was born in the first conflict, and after it ended, we had a very, very peaceful and precious period of time. I remember very well when I was little, we had all our businesses in these shops, you can see them here, and there wasn't a wall, obviously, there. And that used to be the main road between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. So, and across the street from my house is Rachel's tomb, one of Jacob's wives, as you may all know. She gave birth to Benjamin right across the street here. And when she was giving birth to him, she called him in Hebrew, actually, son of my sorrow. And then his dad, after her death, called him son of my right hand. So almost a prophetic picture of what on the entrance of the city, what would happen years later, where you have Jesus who became son of my sword, son of my right hand. And I would say I never understood or managed to grasp hold of the privilege I had being born there, because, or living there, because after this peaceful period of time where we had Jews, Orthodox Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews, the ones who are like with these kind of curlies and they dress weirdly, they're a bit cuckoo sometimes. Some of them are lovely, they used to come and buy from our shops, and when there are celebrations like the feasts, like the biblical feast and the Torah, they play music out loud all night long sometimes. So we got used to them, we had peaceful actually relationships with them, and it was a beautiful, peaceful period of time where we had Muslim friends and Jewish friends and Christian friends. It was very prosperous. Then until the Second Intifada started, and that's when I lost any interest. Or I actually was, I would say, more grumpy with God for being born in that place or living in that place. And we begged my parents to get us to leave, because this whole area turned into a war zone for 5 years every day. On a daily basis, in the morning, we had the Palestinian youth would be protesting up to the Rachel's tomb just beforehand, throwing rocks, and then on the other hand, Israelis would send soldiers who are as well between 18 and 20 years old. And mind you, some of the Palestinian kids would be actually in the early teenage and probably late teenage. So on both sides, what I've experienced myself and my family were both mainly teenagers. And I mean, if you look at it from that lens, it's a tragedy waiting to happen over and over again. And seeing that during the daytime, and then things escalated to the point where actually the Palestinians would stop shooting at Rachel's tomb as an act of protest, and the Israelis would just send more military and shoot back. I see. And as a result, actually, the Israeli military built a military camp behind my house, 5 meters. So on the other side, if you see it that way, it's all on Google, actually, you can find it. And basically, all the clashes, all the bullets, all the rockets were coming from the Israeli side, passing by my house to hit the Israeli military camp. Based on the statistics and the amount of bullets I've seen, because our home theater became the windows, looking at all the clashes, a couple of us should have been dead, shot dead. Few rockets should have gone through the house. Some of us should have been injured. None of this happened. And at that point, looking back now, I realized it was miraculous, because my dad almost had a bullet in his neck. It went above his head because my youngest brother, Daniel, suddenly started chatting out my dad's name while we were hiding and praying. At that stage, I wasn't religious. I hated anything to do with religion. I actually wanted to deny that God existed, because ultimately this war, as much as it became politicized later, or now people try to politicize it, I believe strongly it's a religious war. It's heavily entrenched in religion from all angles. The Christians are the least violent in it, because we don't tend to be violent. Even during the Second Intifada, when some of the Palestinian militias asked for Christians to participate in the military resistance, all the Christians almost turned them down, and as a result, the Christians had to pay monthly salaries for these militants, because we weren't participating violently. And I've experienced injustices in that. I mean, we've experienced so many injustices on both sides. I describe us as Christians stuck between a rock and a hard place. It's a saying I've learned in the UK, actually. And the reason why I say that, because I've had a friend who was 11 years old, and we used to spend every day after school for 2 years, because I couldn't go back home because of the clashes. And her and her sister waited for their dad after school, because you normally pick them up late. 2 years later, she was 11 years old, she was in her car with her family, and she got caught up in a crossfire between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and she got 30 bullets in her body and died. During the same conflict, I had an uncle who was one of those Christians who gave the Palestinian militias money as part of not participating violently. He realized that it wasn't going anywhere, it was just perpetuating more violence, and a lot of the people, well, non-violent Muslims, normal Muslims and Christians, but this is civilians at the ambassade, got very tired after a long time of having these clashes on a daily basis. And he was one of the very first people to choose to stop giving the militia money. As a result, they shot him and killed him dead in front of his house. What struck me in those two stories is that the first one was told by the churches and my church to the whole world. They even done a play and brought it to Scotland all the way to perform the incidents. But the story of my uncle, who was shot by Palestinians, didn't get outside of Bethlehem walls. And fast forward, the conflict stopped. And we thought, oh, we'll have hope in having our businesses open again on this road. But then, sadly not, because one day we came back from school, and I remember it very vividly, because it wasn't literally one day. We realized there was a wall that was going to be put up. And we came back, and we found this wall surrounding my house on three sides, literally in one day. It was, I remember the feeling very strongly, because any hope for our future businesses, which in that area was very, very well. I mean, we went from being a very rich family to a very poor family in a very short period of time. And we were hoping that when the conflict and the clashes would stop, that we will have the life again. And sadly, at that stage, the wall was up, and all of our dreams at that point and hope for surviving and having our lives restored were killed. At the time, when we asked why this wall was up, we were told that it was up to take more lands. Israel put it to divide us and separate us from our other cities and to take more lands. Now, both of these information are true, but the third piece of information that I didn't know about until I had to come to the UK was that it stopped 90% of the suicide attacks by the Palestinians. Now, as a Palestinian being taught and told that one side of the story, it made us all very angry. It's unjust to put a wall and take more lands. One of my aunties lost some of her lands in it. Very unjust. And it's not justifiable at all. But on the other hand, when I had the maturity later to realize that actually it prevented my people from being given the chance, out of desperation, indoctrination, I don't know what it takes to program yourself mentally to go and put trap explosions around yourself and go and blow yourself up before anybody else, I can never get my head around it. And it stopped these people who are desperate from having the chance to do that. And obviously my dream is one day that this wall would be torn down. That's one of the reasons why I believe this program is there. However, I believe one of the things that we advocate for as part of our work is that we need to tear down the walls in people's hearts and minds first, on both sides. It's stagnant. It's mainly for the Palestinians. They're suffering more. I'll finish quick. It's stagnant, mainly on the Palestinian side. It's. I would say it creates some sadness for the Israelis when you challenge them. It does. They feel distant. They feel hard-hearted when you tell them, "Well, we're 20 minutes away from you, from Jerusalem." And we get to meet in the UK, and you could tell that they're challenged, but it's a very unhealthy situation and it needs to be changed. And my belief system, or my opinion based on my experiences, after what I've been through, after the wall came up, I decided to become a law student and start studying our legal system. And I came to the realization, or almost the revelation at that stage, that actually I didn't realize how entrenched our government identities on both sides in our religious beliefs. And I realized that's one of the main problems. I mean, I wasn't a believer, I wasn't spirit-filled, I denied everything to do with faith, until, while I was studying about the covenants, someone challenged me about God's whole covenant with the land and the people. And as a Palestinian, I thought, if you are claiming as God to say that you have a plan of bringing all these people back into the land and call it Israel like this, you must have a better way of dealing with this, because the way it's dealt with right now is not working. And I challenged him by saying, if to prove your existence to me, you need to explain to me why you've chosen to do it that way. And because of his grace and mercy, he did. He gracefully did, and it saved me. It was the reason why I gave my life to him. Imagine that as a law student, as a lawyer with a law in mind, I needed evidence, and I saw that Israel's existence was miraculous. All the wars, 3 years after the Holocaust, where we as Palestinians would have had the chance of a lifetime to do something good for the whole world by welcoming people who all of Europe was killing. We miss it. We miss it where we could have had a Palestinian state for the first time when it was offered to us, after occupation after the other. Not one mention at our school system telling us that 16 to 18,000 British soldiers, died liberating us from the Ottomans. Not an ounce of gratitude we had, or they had, now I have, because I've learned it, to give us this hope and peace and some freedom. And yes, they divided the land, but they made it make it sound to us that there were never Jews in there. Jews have never left the land. We lived together all side by side. We were all there. Jews were calling themselves Palestinians because that's how the land was called for 2,000 years. So after all the realization of that was the reason why I gave my life to Jesus. And I decided publicly, because I was passionate, young and naive, I'd say, a bit crazy, to say I acknowledge Israel's presence, because on our maps it's still Palestine. There's no, okay, this is Palestine, this is Israel. No, it's still Palestine. So I decided we can't be in denial, stay in denial, so I'm going to recognize Israel's presence. As a result, I had death threats, and that was more shocking to me, by my own people. And I had to leave, and I came to the UK 7 years ago, and they granted me political asylum in 3 days because they realized the amount of danger I'd be under. I didn't have many clues. I was just following up, literally, God. I didn't realize how intense or dangerous it was until I came here and I sat before the immigration office, and they said, we're aware, we can't send you back. And I realized that people are being merciful. I was like, was it that bad? But I knew I was being followed. I knew it was very big. You could feel the danger, but by God's grace, he was protecting me. And then I stayed here, and that's when I started. He opened doors for me to start speaking to churches, Islamic places and synagogues. And it was about asking people not to take sides. And to my surprise, I came across a lot of churches who do take sides. They forget the humanity on both sides and take sides. And that's what we actually, that's our heart, that's what we work for. Deborah will share with you now, because I have to stop. or some of the work that we do, or the vision behind the prayer room, but this is part of the work we do. And our message is to invite people, no matter who you are, do not take sides. People on both sides are desperate. Yep. They are desperate.
Thank you, Christy. Thank you very much. We'll hear a little bit more from Christy later, and then hopefully, but also do grab her and chat a bit to her afterwards and stuff. Actually, before Deborah comes up, Richard's going to just go through some of the sort of visuals and explain what prayer room is about, maybe,
yeah.
I think.
Exactly.
Hey everyone. I have a lot of imposter syndrome right now, standing up here. I feel like
go for it.
You guys are amazing. So I'm not going to take up too much time because I'd love to leave time at the end for questions. But we've got a few pictures of when we arrived. It was a privilege to go. Ian invited me last year for me and Callie, my wife, to come and lead worship as we commissioned this prayer room in the Anastas house. When we arrived, we got to the house. As it was mentioned, this house is surrounded by the wall on three sides. So we took a walk along there. As you can see, that's a Banksy picture of two angels trying to pry the wall open, which I feel is actually quite a powerful prophetic image. This is one of the towers where I guess you can hear more stories about people kind of shooting from there. That's the view from the Anastas front door, looking out. That is the Anastas house, and the wall goes right around it up there. The next slide is the Waldorf Hotel, the Banksy Hotel. I think what was surprising for me coming there was actually it felt like a place of peace, although there was this oppression that was there. So many people, before you go to Palestine, you think, how can you go there? It's like a war zone or something. And actually, no, there's so much hospitality and peace as you go along there, but also so much oppression. This is, can I pause that? I'm not sure, but that's the view from the prayer room that was set up. I'll go through more pictures in a sec of the prayer room. But I felt what was so powerful is that as you're in this place of praying for God's kingdom to come, you can look out and see the wall right there. And in one of my prayer times, I kind of had a picture of God walking along the wall and looking out over Israel and Palestine and just letting out this shout of pain and of declaring freedom. And as he did it, that the spiritual walls, the cultural walls, the political walls that were dividing across both lands were being broken down. And I do believe that as God spiritually breaks down walls in this land, that once that happens, there will be the physical wall that will be able to come down. So that is, I think, the real amazing thing about having a prayer room right here is that it can be a place like a hot spot where it can just be steeped in prayer, a prayer for peace and reconciliation. That being said, we also had a lot of fun while we're So that's us in the Dead Sea.
Very prophetic.
Yeah. Waiting for Hannah's talk to come true.
Yeah, exactly. Come on. That is a shot of Jerusalem. We were able to see sites in Bethlehem, in Jordan. That's the Mount of Temptation behind Ian.
Jericho. Is that Jericho?
Not Jordan. Jericho. Mount of Temptation, where they have a place of prayer there as well. So we're able to visit that. That is the Garden of Gethsemane. Mm-hmm. So we got all our tourism in as well. But it was, again, profound to be on both sides and see the history on both sides. So I'm going to skip through some of these. This is actually, this picture here is the shot as you come out of the Holocaust Museum. Looking over Israel, and again, as it has been mentioned already, I think we've moved on to the prayer room, but that is one of our painters. So we had times of worship, of preparing this room. Let's move on from that picture. there we go. Yes, as I was saying, again, kind of seeing that Israel had come from a place of brokenness and oppression, and then looking out and seeing that right now, there is brokenness and oppression. When we were in the Holocaust Museum, we saw how they put up walled cities to ostracize the Jewish people. And that is happening in Palestine. And there's this sense of history replaying itself. But we believe that that God can break that and bring peace. So these are some of the shots. That's Chrissy's mum.
I like it. I'm not sure if she looks like
Miss your family. It was such an honour to be hosted by the Anastas family. They opened up their home, they opened up the table, they opened up their arms to us, and it was a real privilege. The idea behind the prayer room was so the artists came and they felt a kind of a real prophetic sense to try and make this place a place of kind of a picture of Eden in a sense, and our hope of peace and God breaking through. I'm going to skip through some of these so again you get a sense of the prayer room there, which is a beautiful place. They've done an amazing job.
Yeah.
So anyone who's, if you're visiting, please, yeah, Dennis can give you the information. Yeah, please pay a visit, spend a night, pray through it. I think what was amazing, we had, this is moving on to the wall now, but just before I go there, after the week of painting the prayer room and getting that up, we had to kind of commission it, we had a time of worship, we had a communion, and then that night we just prayed through the night, and it was during that night that I had this picture of God walking along the wall and proclaiming peace over the land. What was also amazing is that the artists painted the wall itself as a symbol. I think they said that they had a picture of God saying that as they put paintbrushes to the wall, it was creating cracks. And so it's amazing to see these images of hope and color and brightness. I think originally their concept was that those were people offering up prayers, but as they did it, they felt that it was actually, they would prefer that those were kind of gifts of the Spirit coming down, that God was sending down hope, peace, and love that he was sending down to the people of Palestine. So these are the last few bits. But it was a really beautiful experience. And there is the street there outside the house. So great. I'm going to pass on to Debs. She can tell you more about how you can get involved.
Thank you. Wow, really emotional. So the prayer room, I first met Christy, we established 5 years ago in London. I had never been to Israel or the West Bank. I knew nothing about it. I thought the West Bank was a like West Side Story, it might be a musical. I was very involved with my church at the time in ministry at HTB in London, and I wasn't really interested in anything other than HTB in London. I had a very simple life. And very naive and very self-focused, I think, in retrospect. And I met Christy at a book launch, and I had just recently been invited on my first trip. Bizarrely, funnily enough, I think Graham's here today speaking, Graham Coleman. And I got invited by someone else twice in 1 week, and considering I'm meant to be prophetic, I didn't really see it as a sign that I was actually being told by God to go to Israel and the West Bank. And when I met Christy, and it was established that I was going on this trip in the following January, she said to me, would you go and visit my family in Bethlehem? And I didn't know anything about intifadas or separation law, and I just said to her, sure, I'll go and visit your family. And she said, specifically, would you pray for them? I'm like, yeah, sure, I can pray for your family. Anyway, get on this trip, and it was full of, you know, quite intense people. And all these people kept saying to me, are you sure you want to go to Bethlehem? It's very dangerous. You really do you want to go to Bethlehem? And I'm thinking, what's the big deal here? I've given this young lady my word. I'm going to go to Bethlehem. And my experience was that it was a Wednesday, and we'd gone to Yad Vashem in the morning as part of this tour, as you know, the Holocaust Museum. And in the afternoon, they put me into a bulletproof bus, which I was thinking, this is slightly over the top. And we drove down this very, you know, beautiful avenue, the road from Jerusalem, and then we pulled off this kind of track and approached this checkpoint, checkpoint 300, as Ian mentioned, and I thought, what on earth is this? I grew up in California, so I crossed the California-Mexico border, but nothing prepared me for what I saw here. Anyway, fast forward, I came back to my hotel that night, having met the Anastas family, having prayed with them. I got back to my hotel room that night, and my life had changed irrevocably. And all I can say is, in the space of one day, I had seen, as Ian had said earlier, the extreme persecution of the Jews on one side, to the extreme persecution of predominantly the Palestinian Christians on the other side. And God spoke to me that night, and he said, he literally put his hand across the table. I don't know if any of you have ever had a crazy experience like that. He cleared the table and he said, give up everything. This is what your life is for now. And I was like, what? You must have got the wrong person. As I was weeping in the lump. Anyway, fast forward a couple of years, Christy and I started working together on these projects. We did a project helping Syrian refugees. And then I was in Bethlehem in her bedroom, funnily enough, because her bedroom is like my bedroom, actually, in Bethlehem. And I was overlooking the wall one morning, and I was watching this little bird, and God has a way of using birds that are very prophetic for me. And I was watching this bird sing and dance on the wall, and I felt Abba say to me, I want you to bring music to the wall. So last June 2018, we raised £30,000, and we brought 7 amazing British and Canadian spirit-filled musicians, and we played the same music on both sides of the separation wall. Because when I got back to London, I said to Christy, oh, Abba's inviting us to bring music to the wall. And he, in that moment, said, same music on both sides of the wall. And again, we came up against this resistance, people saying to us, oh, you can't do that. Ooh, you must pick a side. You have to go to Israel. Oh, you can't go to both sides. And I was like, well, God said I can do it. So I'm just, I mean, I know my side is not even ignorant, but I'm like, well, I'm just going to follow what he said. So we did it, and it was incredibly moving and profound. It was a very hardcore trip, and I think something that Christy and I have realized through part of this journey, and in fact it's just been hitting us this past couple of weeks, so if you do fancy raising a prayer for us occasionally, this is it, is that I think we take on these projects slightly naively. If God's asked us to do something, we go and do it, and yet sometimes we don't necessarily feel we have backup. We do have a lot of backup now, obviously, 24/7, and our friends at Glasgow Prophetic Centre in Scotland, and the other guys who helped us, who are a church in Florida, bizarre, but that was another God. So I came back from that trip feeling quite shattered and quite emotional, and Christy and I were going down to what I call the holy side of Wandsworth, which is basically a shopping centre, south side, for anyone who knows Wandsworth. And as we were walking down the road, literally about a week after I got back, feeling quite shattered from this music trip, God speaks to me very clearly, and he says, I want you to open a prayer room in the house in Bethlehem. And I was like, the minute he said it, it was just like, oh yes, of course. I turned to Christy and I said, I'm inviting us to open a prayer room in your house in Bethlehem. And she said, yeah, okay. So the prayer room is a prophetic room. It's been birthed out of a prophetic vision for bringing the wall down. It is slightly under the radar, which is why it's called off-grid, because of the Anastas family and the persecution of Christians in the West Bank in particular. We can't be like, whoa, we're here praying for Christians in the West Bank. Being very American. It is very... rock and roll Jesus! Sorry. But we take it very seriously, and we feel like, talked to Ian and Rich about this yet, but literally last week we were in Glasgow at a prophetic conference, and I felt Abba say, I'm taking you up to the next step now, and this is really, we're going to start to really step up here. So the wall, it's a prophetic room. It's very, very prophetic to be able to pray over the wall and pray for the peace of Jerusalem, although we wouldn't wish you to shut that out of the windows of the Palestinian house. But our vision is the vision that God has given us, is that as we stand together in unity with our brothers and sisters, we're hoping to partner with some prayer houses in Jerusalem, We're also hoping to do a burn 24/7. I just told Ian Rich about that about 5 minutes ago. And on the first year anniversary in March of next year, 2020, that's about it. If you guys have any questions, we do have these postcards. Some of you had them if you came in late. We've got the Bethlehem. We just, Christy and I literally pulled the website together about 3 days ago because she's amazing with tech now. I'm not very good, but we built a website. You can book slots in the prayer room. There's fax, there's information on there, or contact me in if you want to book a trip.
Thanks. I've got about 15 minutes left, so various things you could do, but I just wondered if people had questions for anyone, really, who shared. Just it's been a whistle stop tour of a lot of stuff, you know, being thrown out, so it's just anything you'd like clarity on or wondering about. So anything to do with Israel is a very emotive subject. So.
I just want to thank you all for your perspective there. And I feel like my experience with people I know really involved in Israel bring a lot of opinion and quite caught up in the emotions of it, so I just want to like what you said about people. It's people on both sides, and we need to see. That was really significant. So my kind of question would be, so like my really good friends were involved in the Israel prayer breakfast that happened recently, and we just met and prayed for the whole nation and everything. My question would be, how do we open that discussion amongst Christians in the Western world? You know, like what do you guys feel about that? What do you think?
I suspect we've all got something to say.
From my point of view, I think the thing that shocked me the most was I went on my second trip the year later, and I'd taken my husband. We'd gone to stay in Christie's house in Bethlehem for 3 nights, and then we'd gone to join this tour in Jerusalem, and that was when this lady asked me directly. You know, she got very quite aggressive with me, and she said, "You've been in Bethlehem." And it was all like, "Yes." Was it Dane? No. And then she said to me, "But you do know why we're here, Deborah, don't you?" And I said, "To do a trip." I kind of really don't know. And she kind of slammed her hand on the table, and she said, "We're here for the Jews. We're here for the Jews. Whose side are you on?" And the minute she said that, I was like, "Whoa!"
Wow.
And I was hit. And you know that scripture, there's that line in the Bible that says, "You open your mouth and God will put the words in it." I found myself quoting to her out of Joshua chapter 5, because I had now completely written down in my heart, where Joshua is on the road and he encounters the angel. And the angel of the Lord says, and he says to the angel, "Are you for us or our enemies?" And the angel says, "Neither. But as a commander of God's army, take off your feet, your shoes, because where you stand is holy ground." And I found myself quoting that after, and I'm like, "Whoa, that sounds clever. I didn't even know I knew that." But in that moment, I said, "What Ian said." I said, "I'm not. I'm on God's side, and as far as I'm concerned, He's for all people. And it would be ignorant and naive of me to pick a side. That doesn't make sense." And as a Christian, anywhere I check my heart, I mean, obviously, there's things that happen on both sides, like. There's that thing in Revelation where it says, Abba says, you know, "I hate the sin, I don't hate the sinner." And that's helped me particularly kind of try and, as much as I can, keep an open mind.
That's perfect. I just would add on the back of that, is as a Christians, we forget that our role here on earth is not to judge non-believers. When you talk about Palestinians and Israelis, none of them are spirit-filled. On what ground are we going to judge them? Obviously, there are basic morals that we can uphold humanity on by saying this is unacceptable. But ultimately, as someone who you can say this is unacceptable, but then you can't lead after that with hatred or bashing or judgment. You have to love both sides. Even the guys who kill themselves, or the suicide attackers, or the soldiers who just are just brutal on the checkpoints. Some of them are just very, very angry. Our roles aren't to judge either sides. If we want to play a role in this, the only role is to try and build bridges and seek reconciliation by investing and getting proximate with both sides and try and as much as we can to invest in both sides as equally as possible. If people have, with the Christians, if people have, because of all the prophecies, if people have an issue with Israel's existence and everything, tell them to take it up with God. Because it's, sorry, I mean, if he, it's not because of the sake of the Jews, not because of the sake of the Arabs, not because of the sake of anyone that Israel exists now. It is miraculous if you look at the evidence, and it's coming out of a Palestinian mind. One I paid a heavy, very heavy price to state that. However, I am very happy to stand up and say there are certain things that we cannot keep defending without challenging with love, out of place love on both sides. Mm-hmm. And we just need to be aware that there are mistakes and faults on both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing that struck me was how I think, you know, the often it's left wing, which is very, very pro-Palestinian, but to the absence of any sort of understanding of Jews in Israel and so on, of Israel. And but the mentality, what it must do to your psyche to be, have gone through the Holocaust and then be in this little nation,
yeah,
surrounded by huge nations that are committed to wiping you off the face,
yeah,
of the earth. You know, I can understand, I think it's wrong,
oh, yeah,
but I can understand why a government would be very strong in saying, it's a bit like, you know, apologies for South Africa, I'm not Peter here, but, you know, South African said to me, you know, apartheid came about because of the British concentration camps. Well, that was a large factor which killed women and children. And after that, the Afrikaners say, we will never be treated like this again. And therefore, they introduced this whole thing of apartheid. They were traumatized, so they became, you know, strong. And I think that, you know, the mentality in Israel, if we show one bit of weakness, we will be wiped off the face,
yeah,
of the earth. But then the other side is, you look at, you know, what it, one of the impacts it's having is driving Christians out of Bethlehem, which then is empowering Islam in Bethlehem, so that, you know, and radical Islam at that. So it you know, what's happening at the moment, the fruit of what is happening at the moment is not good.
Yeah.
And there has to be a better way.
I think what
does that help? Yeah. Does that?
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah.
I hope you can hear me. I've got a very strong voice. I'm actually South African now that you said
that.
But also, you don't know how absolutely delighted I am at what has happened. I'll tell you why. In 1968, I had a kind of a gap year. Couldn't wait to get to Israel. On the bus to Jerusalem, and the bus stopped, and they said, you've got to get off. I said, why? They said, it was too dangerous. We're not taking you to Bethlehem. And they dropped me outside your house.
Wow.
Oh.
At Rachel's tomb.
Oh, wow.
That's where I was.
Oh, wow.
So it was, I don't know, I didn't realize the significance of the time, but I looked across the valley towards the hills, and I thought, you know what? That's where the angels sang.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, I had to get on the bus back to Jerusalem, and I had to get a charut down to Bethlehem,
wow,
and all the rest of it. But then, 5 years ago in Vienna, I stood up and I asked in the room, I can't remember which seminar, I said, have you got any prayer rooms in Israel? Dead silence. Oh, that's tricky. I thought, I'm not so keen on that. And here you are. I'm just absolutely thrilled to this. I was there again in 2016. I was in Jerusalem on work. Just looked out over the hills towards Bethlehem and just prayed.
Thank you.
Comfort my people.
Yeah.
Mm. That's it. Comfort my people.
Thank you.
Mm. Oh, by the way, the peace wall in Belfast.
Mm.
Have you done?
It's a bit crazy. We're here talking about that. We said to our friend Caroline this morning that, you know, every Uber driver we've had this week is like, oh, I've got to the peace wall in Belfast. I'm like, wow. Yeah. Of course, they're Catholic. I'm like, oh, no, not again. but one thing I did want to add is we just did a trip to Norway where we were, Christy was speaking, and there was a lot of people who come up to us. It's a political organization who invited Christy, and we've spoke at this, and but because it's Israel, a lot of Christians come to these meetings, and they would come up to us at the end, and this was just about a month ago, and This is another interesting thing, just to put it out there, so you can share this with your friends, is that a lot of people come up and they were saying to us, oh, we're actually going to Israel on Saturday. Oh, it's amazing you've come to speak to us. So we'd say, brilliant, go to the prayer room. And immediately, and he said, Bethlehem? You want us to go to Bethlehem? And I'm like, oh, you guys are Christians, and that's where Jesus was born, and everybody's got to cross the checkpoint. It's just like the resistance is so strong, and we really felt it on that trip. And while they were very pro, what you everything, like very encouraging.
Yeah. They were challenged,
the invitation.
Massively challenged in a way. But yeah, so but they were like, you can tell they were open. But then say, go and maybe visit, and there's a bit of fear there that you could see. And I guess because we're at the beginning of the earth, I'm probably by far the Holy Spirit will soft and hopefully Christians' hearts to start going there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How far away is this prayer room from the church in the Nativity?
20 minutes by foot.
Well, you walked
minutes.
It a few times.
I walked it as well, yeah, 25 minutes.
25 minutes.
The first time, the second time took me an hour and a half, but that's because
yes.
I took the wrong road. I kept saying, it's just, we're nearly there.
Yeah.
And we ended up, we finally did get there.
But it's a very easy place to get to, because if you cross through checkpoint 300 to get to the Church of Nativity, you kind of drive in around this big loop in Bethlehem. You are literally, it's literally just across the checkpoint. It's kind of the first road on your right, if any of you just happen to be in the area. And if you're walking through the checkpoint, it's literally just straight down, and you get to
3 minutes walk, and the house is there.
And I was there at the end of September in Bethlehem, just a very quick visit into church and the Nativity. But
we call it the supposed birthplace of Jesus.
We waited a long time to get down.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, we were thinking kind of, you know, is this going to be like, you know, very touristy, you know, that kind of thing? Will we actually feel the presence of the Lord at all?
Yeah.
You know, in some of these places, how it can be.
Mm-hmm.
And surprising to me, actually we did.
Yeah.
We were there on a feast day, it was the Feast of the Holy Cross, so we had to wait about 2 hours to get in, and we were on the circular steps, sitting, just waiting to go down into the grotto for about an hour and a half, which was very, we were all stiff after that.
Mm-hmm.
But actually we could look down and we could see three different denominations, they were having their services.
Yeah.
And actually it was very powerful.
Yeah.
It was kind of surprising to me.
Well, what's beautiful about that is, you know, it says where there is unity, God commands his blessing. So there is that going on there.
Just practically, I mean, it's been referred to, but the house is, so if you're staying in Jerusalem, you get the bus to the checkpoint and then walk over and you're there. You immediately get harangued by about 50 taxi drivers, all demanding to give you a lift, and you just say, well, we're only going down there. Ah, it doesn't matter, I'll still give you a lift. No, just keep walking. I think it's around $25-$30 whatever a night in the guest house, so you can actually stay there. So you could actually even use it as a base
for Jerusalem.
By staying there a lot cheaper than it is in Jerusalem,
yeah.
and then walk to the checkpoint
yeah.
through, get the bus down to the city. So, so there's lots of things like that. So, or as we did it, we stayed a few nights in Jerusalem and a few nights in Bethlehem and did different things. But, you know, taking some time to pray, but also just using it as a base for seeing other stuff.
Yeah.
And if you're lucky, you'll even be treated to a meal with the Anastas family, which is quite an experience.
it's
wonderful. A good experience. A good experience. With Palestinian hospitality.
Yeah.
And pop into the Banksy Museum.
Yeah.
I feel like we should pray for you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I don't even know what
we're going to do. We'll pray for these guys, I think, because we're sort of a bit outsiders on it. But I think just practically, Rich and Callie are taking a 20% mission team. Details will be up probably around the beginning of December of when it's going and things. So it won't be saying, come and join a trip to Bethlehem, it'll be a Middle East team. There'll be two Middle East teams going on. One will be Turkey, we're sending teams to Central Turkey to pray, and one will be Bethlehem. So if you fancy that, or you know someone who fancies that, do that. Deborah's getting different ideas, like a burn thing. You know, so if you contact her, I'm sure she can put you on some sort of mailing list or what have you. But also, if you've got other ideas, if you just say, as a group of us want to go and we'd love to spend some time there praying, then just let let these guys know and you can fix it up. It's very, very easy.
Yeah.
Any other quick practical questions before we pray?
I feel like there are a million questions.
I know.
I suppose... How do you respond? You know, I'm aware that the evangelical church is a huge part of the problem in all of this. And I was chatting to a friend who talked about going to some Texan businessman's breakfast and, you know, all these high rollers talking about the millions that they were giving to Israel. And I've been a couple of times, and the second time I went, actually, Jensen Franklin, you know, well-known evangelical pastor, was there on the front of the Jerusalem Post, friend of Israel, and the tens of millions that come through American megachurches. I mean, you must encounter your fair share of that sort of outlook. How do you respond? Obviously, faithful presence and sort of refusing fight, as it were, you know, but how do you respond to that? Because it makes me so mad.
That's a very, very good question. I actually, that was one of the things I've done for 2.5 years, just focusing here, going to churches, trying to change the narrative, helping people not to take sides. After a while, I realized I just wanted to hear an epic story, and that was about it. I'll go back to the same church a year later, and they just want to hear a story and the supernatural, and they don't. Their hearts haven't changed exactly. I haven't seen practical outcome. I think I would personally avoid trying to get into arguments and try and change people's lives, people's hearts in that way. I'd rather start doing good and inspiring people to follow along.
Yes.
Because investing our energy in doing good would do us way much better for people, and would be way much better for the people on the ground and for ourselves. And you'll be surprised, a lot of these people stop following.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these people are just following what the prophecies are saying, and sometimes we forget that if we follow the prophecies and we have these incredibly brilliant revelations, we forget that we're still, our mission is to love humanity. And that disconnect can cause people to just go to that extreme. However, there's always still hope to, if we are presented on the loving side, and how we can be humane and take care of people on both sides. And that is a very fine line to walk, because you have to love the Jews as much as love the Palestinians, and vice versa. And you'll be surprised how many people will be challenged. If you just go and hear one story on the Palestinian side, your heart will break. And if you go and hear one story on the Israeli side, your heart will break too. And just finding that balance is not a very smooth ride, I'd say. But yes, I would focus our energy on doing good, and these people would probably, hopefully, start being challenged by that and follow.
I think just yesterday there was two moments for me. One was Pastor Adrian, when he spoke from Ezekiel 47, and he spoke from the beginning of it, and I carried on reading it, and I got to this place.
It's actually a very controversial piece. I haven't read it before.
And it says, you are to distribute this land among yourselves according to the tribes of Israel. You are to allot it as an inheritance for yourselves and for the foreigners residing among you and who have children. You are to consider them as native-born Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
Along with you, they are to be allotted an inheritance among the tribes of Israel. In whatever tribe a foreigner resides, there you are to give them their inheritance, declares the Sovereign Lord. And I read that, I was like, rock and roll, yeah. I mean, I think the thing, like, what Christians I believe in, it is maybe very naive at times, but a lot of times I just go back to the Bible and I go, well, that's what he said, so that's what I'm going to do. On that point, also, what Christy just said is, there's so much attention and focus sometimes on, in my mind personally, the negatives and the wrongdoings and the loads of cash. I mean, goodness, if we had half the cash Albert actually said a funny thing to me the other day, because we like literally working on a song of prayer at the moment, and he said this really beautiful thing. He said that if you've achieved what you've achieved with nothing, think what you could do if you really had like something, and that's almost like, it's almost a model to humanity that we've done this really with nothing. I mean, 24/7 and our friends in Florida. But God's going to have his way, whether it's millions invested into it or peanuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it. And it was then last night that, what was the man preaching last night, the Australian guy, who said that beautiful quote from Margaret Mead, never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever does. I mean, I look at you and what you're doing in South Africa.
Mm.
And I focused on that more, and my friend Mark Glenn, who's got the hope, we see hope now. I'd rather focus on the positives than the negatives, and I think it's very easy for us to get caught up in, and don't get me wrong, because I do get caught up every day in the wrong, and even being prophetic, you know, it's very important, as the guy who did the prophetic thing yesterday spoke about understanding the news. I look at it, but I want to try and view it like, well, this is exciting, or seeing things coming to pass that others said are going to come to pass, and not allowing them to scare us.
And finding hope, yeah.
And finding hope in it.
Could you recommend anything reading-wise that
the Bible.
Well, I know, but I mean, the Bible creates a lot of...
This narrative, I'd say, is quite... I mean, there are a few books I can recommend afterwards. You can come, I'll give you some names. But this narrative is, I feel the Holy Spirit is starting to breathe on. So... probably at the moment you'd find either books for that side or that side, but I think soon in the next few years we'll start finding more books that actually would be able to support both. We have like Brother Andrew, he's done work on both sides. There's Andrew White, who has well done work on both sides. There's Steve Khoury, who the son of Naeem Khoury, who's a Palestinian pastor, who's done work on both sides. There's so many people who actually are starting to walk this walk. So yeah, they're up and coming. I mean, it's something that the Holy Spirit is doing right now.
Pete's last night, his idea of travailing. I mean, that it kind of fits in with that vision of the travailing. There's definitely a move of people who are wanting to be much more for both sides. I think that word attitude.
Is it true that if the Palestinians that live in Israel and born then accepted it, that the Israelis treat them as Israelis, that the same rights?
That's a very good question. We're going to get a bit more politically. They have better rights than what we Palestinians have rights under the PLO, because we don't really have proper system or law and order operating at the moment. But they are still, there's a level of treatment of second-class citizens for the Arabs who are, or the Palestinians who live under Israel. Not like, yeah, there's still slightly that level of...
Well, it's written in the political...
It's written in the... it's a parliamentary democracy, so they don't really have a constitution. So, yeah, there's slightly... But I have to admit, they have better rights than I do as a Palestinian. So... it's a tricky one. It's a more complex than saying that statement. But yeah.
This was, we need to, people awake to come to the next seminar, but they, I think the original source of fake news is probably Israel, because education-wise, you only got one side of the story, didn't you? And the Jews only get one side of the story.
Yeah.
Trying to get to the, and the church often only gets one side of the story.
Yeah.
And the world, wing only gets one side of the story. So it's really important to delve deep and try and get facts and reality rather than just the things we just want to hear. But anyway, someone suggested praying. I'm doing another seminar at the moment, so if I could, can you guys get on?
Cool.
Just grab a few minutes praying. If people need to rush off themselves, please do. But if anyone would like to stop and stay, particularly for Christy, but Christy and Deb, so please do.
Yeah, great. For those who'd like to pray, let's just gather around Christy and Deb's now.